Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm your host, Brian Keane, best-selling author of the book, The Fitness Mindset and Rewire Your Mindset, here to help you by deconstructing expert guests on all things health, fitness and mindset. Today's guest is Nick Velasquez, who is the author of the new book, Learn, Improve, Master, How to Develop Any Skill and Excel at It. Today's episode, we cover a wide range of topics when it comes to learning. So anyone that is looking to improve their ability to consume information, to retain it, you know, some of the myths and misconceptions around memory, we'll get a lot from today's podcast and you'll get a lot from Nick's book. But in today's episode, we keep it very fitness focused. So things with nutrition, with training, so that it's very on scope and kind of on brand for the podcast. Some of the things we discuss are deliberate practice versus repetition and why they're not the same thing. Very important for anybody that is trying to upskill or maintain a higher level of performance, either in the gym or in their sport, for runners, for triathletes, for GA players, for sports people, or just people looking to improve their fitness in general. We also talk about the myth of you either have it or you don't. So genetics and weight loss, things like the stories of I'm being boned versus, you know, building muscle. I can't build muscle no matter what I do. And the myth that you either have it or you don't, and how you can actually learn and retrain and train yourself to kind of hit your genetic limit. We also discuss misconceptions around memory and tying emotion to your learning. So the example here is the perfect deadlift and some of the things you can use to perfect your perform on certain movement patterns that you're trying to master when it comes to your performance, either in the gym or in your specific sport or whatever it is that you're doing. We also geek out a little bit, I definitely geek out a little bit on this, on our favorite authors and books. Nick, one of the things that drew me to Nick first was a very similar interest in books and some of our favorites. So we discussed that in today with a lot of recommendations. And we'd also touch on the myth of motivation and why motivation is for amateurs, which is a very important topic for anybody that is relying on motivation to hit a fitness goal or whatever goal it is that you're looking to achieve. So without further ado, here is today's podcast, very enjoyable conversation with Nick Velasquez on how we learn new skills, why exploration can change your fitness goals, and the myth of motivation. Enjoy. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm delighted to be joined today with my guest, Nick Velasquez. Nick is the author of the new book, Learn, Improve, Master, How to Develop Any Skill and Excel at It, and he is a passionate learner and a devoted student of mastery. He's the founder of the popular blog, UnlimitedMastery.com, where he writes about learning science, peak performance, creativity, and mastering skills. His writing has been featured in outlets such as Time, Forbes, Entrepreneur, and Thrive Global. Nick speaks multiple languages and spends his time between Tokyo and Montreal, and he's currently in Montreal, based on the way the world has been the last while. I think it's in lockdown at the minute in Tokyo, so no one's in or out. But I'm looking forward to breaking down all the myths and misconceptions when it comes to learning in today's show and jumping around with some fitness topics as well, as Nick is very passionate about that. Nick, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Brian, thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure. Mate, I want to jump straight into the book just because you have so much in here when it comes to learning and how to, you know, develop and master any skill. But talk to us about the book first. Why this book and who is it for? Just to talk us through that a little bit.
Sure. So I've always been fascinated with learning. I love learning. I pick up different hobbies all the time. And I was frustrated with how difficult it was going from knowledge into skill. So, for example, you can know a lot about art theory, but not know how to paint at all. So I was trying to bridge that gap and become a better learner so I could add more things into my life, more hobbies, more activities. So I started researching on how to learn and how we learn. So the science of learning, neuroscience. And I was trying to find a book that I eventually wrote. Like, I wanted a guy that would teach me the principles and the strategies to become a better learner, but I couldn't find it. And in the process, like, I read hundreds of books on the subject, and I was compiling all this information, and I wanted to make a sort of a guide, my personal guide for learning. And halfway through that process, I figured if I'm going to do this for myself, if I'm going to create a guide for learning, I might as well just solve the problem for other people and turn it into a book. But had I known the amount of work that was ahead of me to turn that thing into an actual book and polish work, I don't know if I would have done that. It was quite a challenge.
Yeah, you have gone deep on so many different topics. Like, you've broken it into parts just for people listening. Like, part one is learn, and then it goes on into improve, which is in part two, master in part three. And there's just so much to unpack within the entire book. So I can imagine the amount of research that went into it. But I want to start on what has been my personal favorite section, and that's the myths and misconceptions when it comes to learning. And I think for the audience listening to this podcast, I get asked a lot about, you know, learning more for people trying to consume books and just get lots of information from the outside, or even just, you know, how to learn nutrition and apply it in their own life so that things stick, so they're able to, you know, hit a weight loss target or a body compositional target or, you know, building muscle, whatever it is. Talk about some of the main myths and misconceptions there is when it comes to learning.
Yes, I think one of the most relevant one is the myth of you either have it or you don't. So it's this idea that we're either built to do something or we're not. And that's just something that's been going on for a long time. Usually we talk about it in terms of talent. And I guess in fitness, it's just your body composition. I mean, your genetic makeup. There is an important distinction to make there. I mean, yes, there is a part that we can't ignore that it plays a role in our genes and how we're made. Like, we are more adept to certain things than others, but it doesn't mean that we can't improve, that we can't get really good at whatever we chose to do. So the example that I use is basketball. So people always bring up basketball as a way of saying, well, what about basketball? Like, if you're not tall, you're never going to be a great player. Well, that's not true. You might not play for the NBA because, well, we created basketball. It was made up, and it turned out that it gives advantage to tall players. But the actual skills of playing basketball, which is dribbling, shooting, rebounding, things like that, that has nothing to do with height. Now, if basketball had height divisions, like we had weight divisions for sports like fighting, because obviously it accounts for a lot, then we will have great players of all different heights. They will just belong to different categories. So the skill of basketball can be mastered by anyone. It's just that your genetic makeup will give you an advantage in the way we design the game and the way the league is organized, where there's only one division. So it would be the same with bodybuilding. So let's say you don't have a big frame or things like that, but you could still develop and you can still improve and you could build a lot of muscle mass and you could look great. Like, you don't have to look exactly like someone else. So this idea of like going after your very best instead of the best in the world. So for someone to be the best in the world, you have a lot of things that need to go right for you. So you need good genes, you need good coaches, you need some luck, well, the place you were born and things like that. If you want to be among the best, that's different. You need less of luck, less of genes, less of all the things, and still a lot of hard work. For example, we need to remember that, let's say, the greatest swimmer of all time, Michael Phelps, yes, he was the great, but also he wasn't the entire Olympic team, the entire Olympic US swimming team. There were another amazing swimmers there too. So you can be among the best. And the last category is being your best. And for that, you don't need anything. You just need you. And you can improve and you can get really good at whatever you choose to do within the realms of your physicality and within realms of your capability. So why is that not noble enough? A lot of people don't take on a new skill or a new project because they think, well, what's the point? I could never be the best or among the very best. Well, you choose it because you love it. So when Michael Phelps started swimming, he didn't know he was going to become Michael Phelps. No one knew. No one could possibly know. He just loved swimming so much. And it turned out that all the factors allowed him to become the very best. But no one knew he was going to become the very best. And if you love swimming as much as him, you wouldn't care if you could become the best or among the best. You would just swim and become your best. So I think that's one of the most important points of the myth. Like, it doesn't really matter if you have it or you don't. You're just going it for yourself. It's your own path and you don't know where it leads. And the only way to find out is to take it.
I love that. And a line that I get regularly, Nick, is people say, oh, I'm big boned, I can't lose weight. And that's very similar to the either you have it or you don't. Like, that's a mindset shift. And mm-hmm. Something I'll tell people now, again, I'm simplifying a very complicated topic into, you know, kind of a widget that people can kind of just use as a brain tattoo, that genetics generally determine the speed versus what you do. You know, and obviously they're going to tell people in the lines of Michael Phelps, like, not all of us, me, you, we're going to jump in a pool and turn into Michael Phelps. Like, there's going to genetics play a role there, but it's having the mindset to learn and consume the information that can potentially help you on your journey. That is the difference, as opposed to having that closed off mindset or that self-fulfilling story that, you know, I'm big boned, or, you know, I can't build muscle, or I can't get faster, or whatever it is. When there's a very trial and tested approach to do that, if you have the right coaches or you're reading the right books, and in the case of your book, where you're consuming how to actually learn that information. Talk us through the 10,000 hour rule and the myth of that, because this is something that kind of jumped out at me as somebody that was down that kind of Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hour rule to become proficient at something. Break that down for us a little bit.
Sure. If you don't mind, Brian, I'll make one last point, because what you said was great. This idea of like someone taking a little bit longer, or like the speed. And something that I think a lot about is, where is really your passion? And like, what is it really that you want to achieve? And if it's something that really burns inside, you don't really care how long it's going to take. Like if someone, I'm learning Japanese, and if it takes me 10 years, I don't care. And if other people can learn in 6, well, good for them. My process is different. So if you really want to build muscle, like you shouldn't really be so concerned that it takes you longer than other people. If you really want it, that's just your path. And you might excel at all of the things faster, but everyone's different. So that's another point. If you really want it, you shouldn't care. I don't trust people with an easier method when they're not ready to do a harder one. So if I tell you, look, it's going to take you 5 years, and then they run away, they're like, okay, that wasn't for you. But then if I say it's going to take 5 years, and they say, okay, I'm ready to do it, and then I'm going to tell him, well, it's really actually going to take one, but I needed to know how committed you were.
That's a great idea, yeah.
So it's the same. It's the same for bodybuilding. Look, I train a lot. I train every day, and I don't have the results for someone that has been training that long. I know, because I lacked in maybe doing more progressive overload, and for many years I was training with the wrong information, but I keep doing it, and it doesn't matter if it takes me longer, but I'm there, and I know where I want to go. So, all right, that was my parenthesis. Let's move on to the 10,000 hour rule, which is one of the most famous learning myths ever. So in all fairness, so this came from the book Outliers. That's kind of where it first originated. Malcolm Gladwell, he was reporting on the research from K. Anders Ericsson, who's an expert on expertise and expert performance. To his credit, to Malcolm's credit, this idea like took fire, became really popular, and is not accurate. And he came out and he said, look, I didn't report it like the right way. Like it might have been misconstrued, but there's nothing I can do about it anymore. It's out there. So to his credit, that's what happened. He did say like, look, it should have been written a different way. So like the whole thing was more clear, but it's out of my hands now. So good for him. Now, the research from K. Anders Ericsson was on musicians, on violinists to be precise, from a prestigious school in Europe. And he was looking at the practice habits of the best musicians in that school. What he found out is that the very best had amassed, on average, about 10,000 hours of deliberate practice. Now, there are a couple of things there. First of all, it was done in one single skill, not across skills. It was not set out to determine a mastery timeline. It was just reporting an average. Another part of it is like, it depends. For some people, it was 10,000. For others, it was less. It was maybe 7,000. So it was not trying to set out this infinite number or definite number of how to get to mastery. And his point, what he wanted to get at, which is what most people miss, is he wanted to prove that talent play a very small role in your development. He was showing that even the very best musicians in that school, which is one of the top schools in Europe, they all had done a lot of deliberate practice, thousands and thousands of hours. So how could talent be playing such a big role if everyone was practicing so much? And for the most part, the best musicians were the ones that had been practicing for the longest. So that's what he was trying to prove. He was trying to say, look, talent doesn't play that big of a role. It might give you an advantage, but the core, the foundation of mastery is in hard work. And he closes up in his book with this beautiful quote where he says, a deliberate practice can open up a door you thought it was closed to you. Open that door. That's the whole point, is where deliberate practice can take you. It wasn't about how, like the exact hours to get somewhere. And another important distinction that this relates specifically to fitness is that deliberate practice is not the same as repetition. So we all know people that go to the gym day in and day out and they do the same thing, and they don't get results. because they're not pushing themselves to get better. They're not doing like the progressive overload. They're not trying to improve. They're just repeating what they already know. So your body adapts and then it just stops growing. And it's the same for every other skill. If you pick up the guitar and all you do during your quote unquote practice hours is you play the same song you already know how to play, you're not becoming a better guitar player. You're just doing repetition. Same like driving. We've been driving for years and we drive the same way we've been driving forever. At one point we stopped improving. We didn't care anymore. And we just solidified our skill at that level and we never got any better.
Such an interesting mindset, the deliberate practice versus repetition. I love the way you worded that, Nick. I think it's so important because a lot of us can fall into that trap, especially when you become proficient at something that you're like, oh, well, I'll just keep doing what I'm doing. But if you keep doing what you're doing, you keep getting what you got. Like if you've got goals that exceed what you want to do, you have to kind of make those changes. And I'm really curious because it gives me a nice little segue into exploration. So I know you talk about, you know, the principles of learning and exploration and how it gives us a reality check and it helps us to deconstruct the skill. And I've found this time and time again when I go down a new rabbit hole, I'm very kind of training ADHD. Like, you know, I used to be a sports person and then I went into competitive bodybuilding. Now I do endurance and ultramarathons and triathlon. So I tend to mix and match a lot of things with fitness because I get bored. But I thought when I was reading that chapter, I went back to all the different times when I've made that change and how I had to learn new skills. So, you know, learning correct running technique, learning how to ride a bike properly, trying to become proficient in swimming when you come off the back of, you know, multiple hours of weightlifting and sessions for bodybuilding. Talk to us about the principles and how exploration is the start for learning anything new.
So exploration is key because many times what we see in the world is the finished product. We see the polished work of someone. So let's say you see a book that is already edited and reworked and you see the polished end product and you think, this is awesome. I would like to be a writer. That must feel so good. You're going to a cabin in the woods and words just flow through you. And that's not how it works. You think it is that way because you're seeing the performance, the end result of things, but there is a process behind it that is not as glamorous. And that's where you spend most of your time. So only when you start digging deeper and doing this exploration that you find how the craft is practiced, what it entails, that's when you get to decide if there's something you want to do or not. In the case of writing, the art of writing is really rewriting and editing. And it feels like you're trying to put together a puzzle that's fighting back. If you don't enjoy that, you're going to be miserable going into writing. So that's one thing. Let's say in the fitness world, it's the same. You see this, the kind of like the photo shoots, or you see the fitness models, or you see the shows, and you're seeing the end result. You're seeing the glamour, like, oh, that looks so good. I would love to look like that. But you're not seeing the process behind it. So let's say peak week, which is hell, and you're putting your body through all this pain. And it's only when people face that reality, when they look behind the scenes, that they go, oh, wow, this is not really what I wanted. I wanted the result. I didn't want the process. So it's important to see the process behind every skill. And then that's when we get to decide, I want to do this or not. So it's really important because some people make the decisions based on the illusion, based on the performance. They see a painting and they say, well, I'm going to sign up for art school. It's like, well, you should take a course or something first and see if it's really what you like.
How would you recommend people explore that in the initial phase then? Would you, and again, I've kind of got my own process that I've used on this, but I'm very curious to what you would advise people listening when they think they want to do something. And the example I'll give here, Nick, is, you know, I ran a 100-mile ultramarathon in Nevada in 2020, in February last year. And I remember before that race, I was like, do you know what? 100-mile would be cool, but I'd love to do a 200-miler. A lot of the people I follow do 200-milers. That'd be really cool. And then when I started to explore the 100-mile and all the hours it took of training to prepare for that, and, you know, putting business on hold for a bit, not being able to spend as much time with loved ones and family, I'm like, fuck that, I'm not doing 200 miles. I'm like, that's, right. I was like, that's going to take way more. And that came down from the exploration. What's your kind of advice for people who think they might want to hit, particularly a fitness goal in this example, whatever that is, photo shoot, bodybuilding show, bikini show, marathon, ultramarathon, whatever it is. How would you advise people potentially work off that first stages from 0 to 1 of exploration?
Yeah, so a couple of things. One is reading about it. You're just reading what it takes to get there. Another one is talking to people that have done it. Another one is taking like a very introductory course, or like trying the smallest possible version of it. So for you, it might have been like running 2 miles or 3 miles and see how you felt. Another one is watching, let's say, the performance alongside someone that knows what's going on. So let's say if you were trying to get into football, it would be watching a football game with someone that understands all the strategies and everything that's happening in the game and is kind of narrating it alongside you, so you see what's behind the scenes. But I think just the talking to someone who has done it or digging a little bit deeper into the research is going to help. I put on this post recently about one of the fitness shoots that I did a couple of years ago. And I was explaining like everything that went behind it, because a lot of the fitness people, they just put it on and like, I look like this all the time, and they don't show you the process, because not showing the process makes you look larger than life. Like it just happened, like you're special. And when you talk about the process, it's like showing the magic, like the method behind the magic, right? So when you see a magician doing something amazing, you think, wow, that person's powerful, or it's so incredible, I'm amazed. And then when you see how the trick is done, you're like, oh, whatever, I could do the same. So I think a lot of people avoid pointing out the process for that same reason. So I was talking about what it took me to get into that shape and how unhealthy I was for a couple of weeks. And to me, a lot of people complain of promoting impossible standards. And to me, like, there is no impossible standards, only unreasonable efforts. These are the efforts that took me to get there. Is it for you? I don't know, but at least now you know what it takes and you get to make the decision with that information. So I think that's what's important. You're just looking behind the scenes, and that could be talking to people who have done it, researching, reading about it. Those are the kind of the easiest ways.
That's brilliant advice, you know, and I think what you said there, Nick, about not showing the process makes you seem larger than life. And it's interesting, very similar to you, back when I used to do a lot of photo shoots and when I was competing in bodybuilding, I would put up all those photos but never showed any of the process. And also, I wrote about this in my first book about the amount of anxiety and how unhappy I was during that time, but I didn't let anybody see that. And it wasn't until I spoke about it, people were like, oh my God, maybe it's not worth the trade-off, you know, maybe it's not worth the cost of, you know, not enjoying exactly. your life, you know. But so I love it. I love that again, it puts it out there for people and it makes them see. I'm very curious. This is somebody, Nick, who writes books as well. And I think I ask this to everybody who has a book that connects as much as yours does with people. But when you were researching it, you know, you talked about the end product of the book and how it's writing, re-editing, and that's a huge process that people don't see. But when you were doing the research, and this is a very, very well researched book, as somebody that can look at it with a critical eye, just for people listening. But what was the biggest thing that stood out to you? And the reason I ask that is when I'm researching books myself, there's always things or studies or examples that kind of connect with me more and normally make the final cut because they've connected with me. When I say that, what kind of comes to mind when it comes to your book in particular?
Something that's stuck with me was, I was doing all this research and most of it was focused on how we learn. So the internal process of learning, there wasn't much about how to learn. So it was only after you amassed a lot of information that you start making the connections in your mind. And I think that was the greatest moment for me. Like, I needed to read all those books to come out to the conclusion, the strategies and everything else, because you needed all these different pieces from different research to kind of connect in your mind. So it wouldn't have been the same thing if I just found one book that gave a couple of strategies and stopped there. I needed to read all the bad ones. I needed to read the really dry ones. I needed to read the scientific papers. I needed to read all this other stuff. And it all just started combining in my head. And then you start to see a light. It's like, wow, all these principles lead to this. And these are the strategies that work. And they work for this and this other reason. So I think, what was very impactful is that most of the work out there was on how we learn, not on how to learn. That's what made the difference. And because I was trying to build a manual for my life, I tried to create a book that would compile everything anyone could ever need about learning. So if you want to go farther into learning, it's just because you love the science of learning. But I tried to put everything you could possibly need. And my goal was to create something that was the next best thing to a world-class coach on your side. And I use it for myself because that was the whole purpose. I wanted to create a book that I could use for the rest of my life.
Yeah, and you can see that again, it's a book that speaks to you as if you're kind of coaching from your side. And something that jumped out at me on your Instagram page is, you know, you consume a massively wide range of books. And we actually have, I might be wrong on this, but I've seen it on your page and it's got Front Line and Center, which is one of my favorite books ever. It's Poor Charlie's Almanac by Charlie Munger.
Oh, yes. That's amazing.
Like one of my all-time favorite books. Like if I was hard-pressed for my favorite book of all time, it's that one. Now, it's a hard one to recommend because it's quite expensive. It's hard to get. Yes. I get the messages and for everybody in it, but it's a personal favorite of mine. But when it comes to books, Nick, you've consumed so many over the years. I'm just curious, what one or two have you read in the last, you know, 18, 24 months that's had the most impact on you? Again, I know you've gone through a lot of dry ones, some that have really connected, and you've distilled it into your own book here. But from a personal standpoint, what's been one or two of the books that have really connected with you over the last year and a half, 2 years or so?
What I'll do is I'll recommend, or I'll talk about the books that have changed my life the most.
Yes, please.
And so anything by Robert Greene, he's my favorite author.
Yeah, yes, you and me both. Yeah.
So anything Robert Greene, oh my God, it's just, you're just in for a trip. So The 40 Laws of Power, The Art of Seduction, Mastery, The Loss of Human Nature, which is his latest book, his magnum opus. So anything Robert Greene to understand human behavior, that is going to change your life. So that Robert Greene, a book that I recommend a lot, especially for people that don't like reading that much or don't feel like have the time. It's called Too Soon Old, Too Late Smart. And it's a self-development book in a way. There was this psychotherapist. He did psychotherapy for, a couple decades. And he talks about the most common problems that people come up to him with and then how to approach them. So it's a very short read. It's 30 chapters, but it's maybe like 150 pages or so. It condenses a lot of the self-development books that I've been reading throughout the years. So I wish I had found that book much earlier. I highly recommend it. A Man's Search for Meaning, Viktor Frankl, amazing book. When Breath Becomes Air, that's another amazing book. It's the story of this surgeon who starts the book saying he's looking at this test results and he realizes his cancer is inoperable. And he says the difference of this time I was looking at my own tests. So he's just going through his process of death. And it's one of those books that breaks your heart, but then encourages you to live more. Every now and then we need that kind of book, because then we fall into routine and the day in, day out of things. And this just shakes us up and say, am I really doing what matters? And over the last few months, I think my favorite book over the last 2 years was The Psychology of Money.
Oh, I just finished that on Audible. That's a great book too.
Yes. Amazing book for anyone into personal finance or just finance in general. I wish I could write that way. I was mad at myself when I was reading that book.
Everyone has such a unique style though. And again, that Psychology of Money, I really enjoyed that. Too Soon Old, Too Late Smart, another fantastic one. I won't spoil it for people, but about 3/4 of the way through that book, there's 2 or 3 chapters where he talks about his own experience with his family. I think it was his son. That's really grounding, like very hard hitting. And that book's kind of funny. Like he puts things across in quite a humorous way in parts. And then there's this smack about 3/4 of the way through, but it's a phenomenal read. And the only one that I haven't read there is When Bread Becomes Air, so I'm definitely going to get on that at the end of this podcast, Nick, for sure. But let's dive back into yours, because you know, you've mentioned Robert Greene there, obviously, again, my favorite author as well. Absolutely love his books. But one of the other things that jumped out at me was memory. And I think I definitely have gaps in my knowledge around this, because you talk a lot about memory and association, memory and chunking, memory and emotion, all of these things that really kind of broke down a few of the paradigms I had. And I've read a little bit on memory, you know, Robert Cialdini's work on influence and persuasion. And there's a little bit of memory and of how we don't recall things always the way we think we do. And you really open up that. When it comes to memory, Nick, what are some of the biggest misconceptions, or what's the biggest myth you see when it comes to either memory retention or just memory in general when it comes to learning things?
Well, the most important one that I think we can focus on is the difference between recognition and recall. And so recognition is just, you're seeing something that you saw before, and then you recognize it as, of course, something you saw before. So let's put a practical example on this. You meet someone at a party, and that person says their name, and you see this person again on the street maybe 2 weeks later, and you recognize the person, but you can't recall the name. So what's happening here? Recognition is you see this person, and as you're getting the input, it kind of gets run against your database. So your mind is going like, have I seen this person before? It's like, yes, I have. I recognize those features. But the name, you're not seeing in anywhere. There is no cue for the name. So you have to retrieve it from memory, which is a much harder process. So when people say I'm better with faces than names, it's not you, it's everyone. So if I had to ask you to recall the face without seeing the person, you will have just as much difficulty. So this, the way it translates to learning is we read a book, we understand the content, and later on we want to review it. So we go through the pages of like, oh yeah, I remember this, I remember that. No, you're recognizing the information and remembering that you saw it before. It doesn't mean it's committed to memory. So that's one of the issues when we try to review books. So let's say someone reads your book and takes all these notes and underlines all these parts. You're like, yeah, of course. So then they go back and they start looking through the book and they see the underlinings. They're like, yeah, I remember this part and I remember that part. But after they close the book and I ask them, what was this lesson or what was chapter one about? They might not remember, because recalling is a very different process. And when we're able to recall information, that's when we know we committed it to memory. So when you can sit down and teach these lessons to someone else, or just recall them on your own, or start applying them without having to review them, that's when you know it's committed to memory. So that's an important one, because maybe someone's reading about the technique for a deadlift and the key points that they need to keep in mind. And then they open the book and they're like, oh, yeah, yeah, I remember the steps. Oh, yes, I remember the sequence. Yeah, I remember what are the points I need to remember. They close the book and then next day they go to do the deadlift and they forgot 50% of it. So we have to be kind of careful of whenever we see information and we think, oh, I know this already. Most likely we don't. We're just recognizing it. We realize that we know it when we can explain it to someone else. We can remember it on our own, or we can apply it without having to go back to review it. So that's a very important one, I guess, a key one for memory, and related to the discussion we're having of improving skills, and in this case with fitness.
And a great example there with the deadlift, something that I've tried to do kind of unbeknownst to myself, is you're giving cues that are references to other things. So when I tell people about a deadlift, I'll tell them, well, pretend like you're sitting down into a chair and you're holding the bar. And if you're able to not fall over with the bar, you're not in the correct deadlift position, because otherwise your back becomes rounded. And those cues to, you know, everybody sits in a chair and knows how to sit in a chair, can be helpful when it transitions over to a movement like, say, the deadlift. But how would you recommend we improve that then, Nick? I know you go through this with process and outcome feedback and the importance of feedback. How would you recommend we improve our learning then, or improve the memory retention of things that we're trying to consume or trying to learn?
So one of the best ways to commit information to memory, it's called practice testing. Essentially, it's like doing a test. Like, we're all familiar with tests. We have to do them in school. It's the same idea. So let's say you as a coach, someone's going to do a deadlift and you say, please tell me what are the 3 or 4 key points that you need to be aware of when you're doing the deadlift. And if that person is able to mention them at that point without reviewing the information, it's like, okay, now they're committed to memory. And now let's start putting them into practice. So that's an easy one, where you just kind of asking someone as a sort of test to see if they know it or not. And it could just be in conversation. You could be asking me, hey, Nick, what are the 4 key points? And then I'll be like, well, I need to remember that I'm trying to imagine that I'm sitting in a chair and then like press my armpits or things like that. And if I miss one, that's when you go back and you review. What's interesting is when we do practice testing, when we're doing this kind of test or trying to recall information from memory, the effort that we put into recalling strengthens the memory. So we're better by trying to recall and putting effort into remembering. And second, if you forgot something, now your mind is more keen to learn it when you review it. So I remember I failed this test in university for one question. And when I think back at my university years, now that's the only thing that I remember is the question that I got wrong, because I got so mad and I went back and reviewed it. And now you have all this emotion behind it, which emotionally improves learning. When we're emotionally kind of aroused in any way, either anger or excitement or whatever it is, then the information sticks better. So rote repetition, which is just saying things over and over, is not as efficient. We're more efficient in memorizing things when we add emotion to it. And we associate it with things we already know, or with things that are similar, like what you said, the idea of think you're sitting down in a chair. That analogy is very visual, is relatable, it's easy to commit to memory. So that's kind of how we go about improving our memory for this particular example.
Can you manufacture that adding of emotion? Again, I know things like anger, it's going to be situation and experience dependent, but is there a way to like manufacture that adding of emotion so that you can improve the memory retention?
Yes, you could do it. So you could do it by imagining things. So an easy example here of what we're talking about, when you said, think you're sitting in a chair, you could manufacture the emotion by saying, imagine you've been running a marathon, or you've been standing up all day, like doing guard at a palace, like at the king's place or whatever, and you've been dying to sit down. And now you finally get to do it. And that's the position you want to be in. So you're kind of taking people on this, because whatever we imagining emotions is just the same for our nervous system that if we were leaving them. So if I tell you to imagine a drop of lime falling on your tongue, you're going to feel like it did. Like your body's kind of is going to react in a lesser degree than the real thing, but it's still going to react to it. So if you imagine salt and lemon falling on your mouth, then you're going to react kind of like if you put it. So we can manufacture those emotions by imagining things. So we can use, there's this great example from a book called, I think, The Talent Code, Daniel Coyle. And he says, imagine that if you're playing guitar, you want to have a light touch. So imagine that the strings are on fire, and then they burn if you touch too hard. So that's a way of adding emotion and also adding a visual cue. That's how you manufacture that.
That's so useful. It's one of the things I'm doing at the minute, Nick, is trying to improve my swim. And the three cues that have stuck to me, it's from, I can't remember the name of the author, but it's a basic book on swimming outdoors or swimming in open water, where he talks about breathing like a dolphin, floating like a log, and swimming like an arrow. And it's amazing how that, the wording of that, makes it stick. So when I'm in the pool or I'm out in the open water, you're trying to recreate that, and those things can really help. And I think adding that emotion to it, 100%, as you said, it makes it stick more. When it comes into mastering something, which is the next level up, I know this is a whole Pandora's box when it comes to kind of next level, but yes. Is it as straightforward from the start in terms of just our how to become a master of whatever it is, you know, and that this is such a subjective term, you know, I would consider myself a master in certain areas when it comes to fitness because I've been training for more than 20 years. So there's certain things that just come to me more natural than others. But is it as simple and straightforward in terms of the mindset approach to it as deliberate practice versus repetition? Again, you know, you don't practice doesn't make perfect, practice makes permanent. Like deliberate practice, I think, is a better and definitely a more appropriate word. But when it comes to the key to mastering something, is that the start of it, deliberate practice versus repetition, or is it something else?
When we take mastery is just it's a point in the spectrum of learning. So we start as a beginner, we go to intermediate, then advanced, and we reach mastery. So we see it as something very magical, but in reality it's just the natural progression of things, but it's on the high end of the spectrum. Now, so the process doesn't change. You're learning and improving every step of the way. So deliberate practice and memory, understanding things, practicing them, all this, the process remains the same. What's very different for us to get into mastery is the mindset. It's sticking with it, first of all. So doing the work and doing it every day. That's one part of it. Like it becomes such a big part of your life. No one falls into mastery by accident. No one wakes up and like, oh yeah, I ended up being a master on whatever. If it was a commitment, it was something that they started doing then every day and putting in the work, because it's not easy. You're going to be making sacrifices and going through pain along the way. So it kind of starts with this idea of a commitment to a skill or craft. And in that sense, we're supposed to develop the attitude of a master before we become one. So there's this great story of Bob Bowman, the coach for Michael Phelps. He was yelling at Phelps saying, like, are you going to wait until you have a medal around your neck to act like a champion? It's acting like a champion that's going to get you the medal around your neck. So the trophies and the medals and all this stuff is just recognition of a master, not the making of one. So we have to adopt this attitude of thinking that we are acting already like masters. We're acting already as an Olympians before we can ever get that recognition. So that's one of the things, is that developing that attitude. Another point, the major one is doing the work and is doing that every day and is showing up whether you feel motivated or not. Motivation is for amateurs. You got to do the work whether you want it or not. And a great example, I was researching Usain Bolt, and you always see him so happy at the Olympics and doing his poses and smiling and laughing. And you think, well, that guy just loves running. That's just his thing. That's why he's so good. And I was watching these documentaries of him training, and he would be running and then he would stop and then start throwing up and then keep running like nothing happened. Like, what? This can't be real. They probably add this for like dramatic purposes. Then they're interviewing him, and he said after he lost some race to a guy named Blake, Bolt said, like, after that, for the next month, I was training so hard, I was throwing up every day because I was pushing myself to the limit. And you would never imagine someone like that saying those things. And he would say also, like, some days you wake up and you know you're going to have to train and it's going to be hard and you don't want to. And you don't want to get out of bed and your mind is telling you, stop, go do something else, go play golf. Because you don't want to do it, but you have to. And it's so hard and people don't know. And you would never imagine Usain Bolt saying those things. So going back full circle about looking behind the scenes, it's not easy. It's not easy for anyone. It doesn't matter if you have the genes. It doesn't matter what you have on your side. You still have to put in a lot of hard work. And that's where most people never reach mastery. They're not willing to make the sacrifice. The way I think about it, the poetic side of it, is that the gods of mastery demand human sacrifice. And it can only come from you. But if you're lucky enough to have found your calling, then it's a sacrifice you willingly make.
Oh, I love that. That's such a great line. And something else that really jumped out at me there, Nick, that I think is going to be, and long-term listeners of the podcast will have a good idea what I'm going to pull from you here, that motivation is for amateurs. That's a fantastic line. Can you explore that a little bit? And the reason I ask, and I know we're talking about it in the sense of mastery, but something I'll say regularly in this podcast is, you know, tell me what you do every day. I'll tell you where you'll be in a year. And it's not about what you do in the days you feel motivated. It's what you do consistently over time. And that line, motivation is for amateurs, is so appropriate for that. Can you explore that a little bit for us, just from your experience when it comes to, you know, the myth of motivation is what I call it?
Yeah, so motivation is cheap and ambition is cheap. The world is full of it and not full of masters. And it's because of that. So sometimes you say you want to do 1,000 things, but you're not putting in the work. So it means nothing. Ambition is nothing if you don't back it up with the work. So it's really doing the groundwork that is the hard part. It's not the feeling, having that kind of spark of emotion that only comes every now and then. What I found about motivation, that this is going to be a funny story, but when I'm at my darkest, and I had some of that in the past month or so, I drag myself to the gym. So I have a home gym and I drag myself there and I sit down because I can't start training. I can't find the drive to start doing it. I just sit on the floor, just looking at the machines. And I'm just waiting for that spark to come. And you know what? It never does. I only get to train when I've said, like, I'm fed up of waiting for this thing. I'm just going to do it.
That's so true.
Because the motivation is not going to come. And I train every day. And there's not a day that I wake up thinking, oh, this is so good. I get to train today. No, I hate it. And I still go do it because I feel great after I do it. So when we talked about Charlie Munger, he talks about first degree and second degree consequences. So first degree consequence of working out is it's annoying, it's hard, you're pushing yourself, and that's not comfortable. But the second degree consequences are you look better, you feel better, you're achieving your goals. So is that one of the things of keeping in mind? Not the process doesn't have to feel elating. It doesn't have to feel like you're so excited and so happy to be doing it. But it's something that becomes part of you and you do it because of the results you get. It also reminds me of this quote from Ernest Hemingway. He used to say, I don't like writing. I like having written. And that to me summarizes my relationship with fitness. I enjoy having worked out, not the working out itself.
I think that one flip in terms of the way you see the situation will help so many people. Again, I have something very similar when it comes to running. You know, I don't like running, but I like having ran. I like the way it feels at the end. I think it's so powerful what you said there. Nick, I loved your book. I've really enjoyed this conversation as well and going deeper on some of the topics in it. And I highly recommend for anyone that wants to go deep on this topic, definitely check it out. Again, there's so much in here and you can read it. Well, I found obviously the best way is reading it linearly in order, but you can jump in and out. You've written in a way that you can jump in and out, and some of the stories in there are really, really good. So I love that. But before we go, Nick, and before you tell everyone where they can pick up the book, I'm curious, in terms of what you're doing at the minute, I know you're in Montreal, I know you go back and forth to Japan a lot, you're obviously training at home, but in terms of what you're doing, what's the thing that's exciting you the most right now? Is it working on anything in particular? Is it the promotion of the book? Is it something completely different? What's the thing that has you most excited at the minute?
Well, I think you're asking me a very hard question at the moment, because I think my life has taken so many turns over the past couple of months. I've always been this bookworm and I love reading. I read a lot. I've been when I was writing the book, I wrote for about 2 or 3 years straight every day. I haven't been writing as much lately. And what has come to mind is that I have sacrificed a lot of my life for a future joy or a future benefit. And I think I'm coming to that point of saying, well, I think this is the right time to enjoy a little bit more. So I'm thinking of taking more extended trips, then keep learning Japanese, then doing things because I love them, not the things that I have to. So I'm stepping away a little bit from work. I'm writing things that I like to write, which is philosophy, but not with the intent of putting a book or anything like that. I think it's the first time that I'm doing things without a goal in mind and more of the day-to-day enjoyment of things. I'm trying to put together the things that I enjoy doing all the time. So one time I was asking myself a question, going back to the fitness part, that if it was a drag for me every day, then why I kept doing it? And I thought, well, I don't envision my life without working out. So I started thinking, what would be my ideal day? And let's think about an ideal day, not in the sense of I'm going to a beach and spending tons of money in a casino or whatever. Not that. I'm talking about the ideal regular day. And I thought my ideal regular day would be something physical. So that's training. Something mental, that will be the reading and the writing. Something creative, that'll be the writing, and something social, so hanging out with friends and talking to people. And that's when it came the realization, well, yes, I want fitness in my life every day, and I want writing in my life every day, and I want reading in my life every day. So I'm trying to build that perfect day, which is going to become pretty much every day for years to come. And the other part that I think I'm doing more is I went through some very dark times over the past few weeks, and I've been reaching out more to old friends and stuff and taking a step back from the productivity side of it. And I feel better. I feel so much better. So I think that's also going to be a change. That's why I'm thinking of traveling more and spending more time with friends, being with them more on the phone. I was surprised to read that Charlie Munger spends like 4 or 5 hours a day talking to friends on the phone. And that didn't make sense to me, because I was also trapped in the myth of the grind, you know? All entrepreneurs, we are like that. We fell into this idea that we have to be grinding 24/7, and then for what? What's going to come after? So I'm trying to take that step back and actually do some of the enjoyment.
I love that. I actually have a couple of things right in front of me here at my whiteboard where I record, and one of them is to, you know, don't make work for yourself. That's my myth of the entrepreneurial grind, where if I don't have something to do, I don't need to make work for myself. That's the downside of that mindset, where you're constantly looking for something to do or think you need to be doing something. But I also have my happy list and my misery list, very similar to what you said there, you know, with the social aspect, physical aspect, the reading, the writing. You know, I have a happy list. All the things in my life that make me happier, make me feel fulfilled, and all the things that make me miserable. The list is right in front of me here. And it just is a daily reminder to do more of the things, spend more of the time on the list with the people who are in there, who fall into that bracket, and then less time doing things that makes me miserable. Sounds so obvious, but yet if you don't question it or draw attention to it from time to time, you can fall into the circle with the people who don't make you feel great, fall into traps and spending too much time for me on email or watching TV or Netflix, things that in a certain amount of time makes you feel good if you're doing it for 20 minutes a day, half an hour a day, but 6 hours a day you start to feel crap about yourself. So it's just a daily reminder. So it's very, we have very similar approaches, but just different kind of tactics to how we do it. So I love that, Nick.
Yes. I agree 100%, Brian. And that's a great exercise. Look at the things that make you happy, do more of it. Look at the things that make you miserable, do less of it.
Love it. That's all. It's so true. Just genius and simplicity. Nick, I've loved this conversation. Thank you so much for your time. Again, I know that things have been crazy over the last while, and I'm really, really grateful we got to chat and kind of do a deeper dive into the book. For everybody listening, where is the best place for them to follow you? Is it online on Instagram? And where is the best place for people to pick up copies of the book?
Yes, for the book, anywhere books are sold. I guess the easiest would be Amazon. So the book is called Learn, Improve, Master. And then for me, yeah, I tend to hang out mostly on Instagram. You can find my social media handles and everything like that on my blog, unlimitedmastery.com. So over there, I'll have the social media, the Instagram. Instagram is where I tend to hang out the most. I try to keep it to one single social media, because otherwise it's just a rabbit hole. And yeah, it'll be great to chat. So if anyone has a question about the book or some comment or anything like that, feel free to DM me over there, and that'd be great.
And everybody listening, I will link up the book either through the Book Depository and Amazon. I'll put them both in the show notes. I'll link up the blog, and I will put up Nick's Instagram. Go give him a follow. Go check him out as well on there, on BrianKeenFitness.com for the show notes, and in the link for the description forever, wherever you are listening to podcasts. Nick, keep doing what you're doing, mate. And thank you so much again.
Brian, thanks so much for having me. That was awesome.
There you have it, Nick Velasquez on how we learn new skills, why exploration can change your fitness goals, and the myth of motivation. So much in today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed recording it. I learned loads from Nick and loads from his book going through it on the different styles of learning and how to improve and how to master any skill. So if you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to hit me up on Instagram. Let me know, Brian_Keen_Fitness and Nick Velasquez as well. You can take a screenshot, pop it up in your story, and you can tag both of us. That's everything from this week's episode. Catch you all next Monday.